Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For a couple of weeks now, it seems as if we're starting every show with news about the snow. Well, of course we are, because winter storms and their aftermath have dominated much of life in New England for the past month.
And that goes for Governor Charlie Baker as well. He's been dealing with storm cleanup efforts practically from the time he took office. He made it known over this past weekend when he met with federal officials to talk about the possibility of a major disaster declaration. If it's approved by President Obama, it would send federal dollars to Massachusetts communities for storm cleanup. Here's the governor speaking to reporters yesterday.
The federal government has a policy in place where they typically will reimburse up to 75% of the cost of snow removal. If you just look at the cost of snow removal from the first snow here in the Commonwealth, that was north of $80 million if you added up all the state and local spending on snow removal.
So clearly we're feeling the cold from our toes to our pocketbooks. But I know that there are at least a few flinty New Englanders out there who simply want to say, quit your complaining. And they have a point. Hard as it may be for we puffy down jacket wearing central heat loving gas powered snowblower pushing city folks to believe, but you know, winter in New England existed before FEMA, before synthetic ice melt, before all those smartphone alerts warning you of canceled commuter rail trains. Basically, for centuries, the native peoples of New England and the settlers who came later lived through winters that were long, dark, and hard. So how did they do it? Let's find out. Joining us now is Professor Robert Allison. He's professor and chair of the history department at Suffolk University and also author of a number of books on Boston history, including The Boston Tea Party and A Short History of Boston. Professor Allison, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
Great to see you. Also with us today from Plymouth is Darius Coombs. He's associate director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation and a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag Nation. Darius Coombs, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. And Darius, let me just start with you, because I'd love to hear a little bit about how the native peoples of Massachusetts survived winter after winter, before, obviously long before any sort of modern technology existed. What, you know, for example, at home, what was it like at home in the early 16th or 17th centuries?
Well, we had houses like people have houses today. Normally the roofing for our houses was on tree bark, and the types of bark you would have seen being used would have been a lot of elm and chestnut bark. Hmm. And the frames for these houses were made usually out of cedar themselves. You want to use cedar because it takes probably 15, 20 years to rot in the ground. But the way you made the houses was pretty much in a round shape. If you took an egg, cut it in half, and put it onto a table, that's the shape of a house we would have.
So dome-shaped, essentially.
A dome-shaped house, yes. So I've been inside these houses here at the museum, actually in blizzard conditions and in hurricane conditions, and the winds go right around them. Mm. It's very aerodynamic.
Yeah.
And if you've been in one of our houses here at the museum, the houses will easily get to be 70, 80 degrees with no problem.
Wow. In the depths of winter.
Oh, in the depth of winter.
Wow. And I've been reading that the native peoples, for example, use some pretty smart tricks to keep warm while being outside, in darkest February.
We have recordings of Europeans seeing native people outside during the winter, sometimes with no top on, the men. But what the men would have on their bodies would have been a lot of black bear fat, a lot of goose fat. What that does is repel the moisture, keeps the cold out and the warm in. Hmm. For us as a people, we spent most of our life outside, and as you're outside more and more, your body will adjust to a certain degree to the weather. Now, that's not to say we didn't wear fur tops, because we did. We had fur tops, but not like how people wear fur coats today. You know, normally you wear the hairs going against your body, And by wearing the hairs against your body, that keeps your body a lot warmer than wearing the hairs out.
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, from records and oral histories that you have, I mean, were the expectations of members of the Wampanoag Nation at the time, I mean, were basically that they were going to move in concert with the rhythms of nature, or that they didn't need to make very many changes because you know, the way that society was set up, as you were saying, with these very well designed houses, it didn't matter what the season was.
No, you normally would have a summer place and a winter place. Come during the spring and summer months, you would come out near the waterways, come out near the ocean, and that's when you do a lot of your planting and fishing. But once you're at harvest time, come and go, you dry those vegetables out and you would bring them with you into your winter community. You would either bring them with you, but also store a lot in the ground so you have something to eat in the spring.
Mm.
But when you went inland does not have to be far during the fall and winter. Inland might be a mile, might be 5 miles inland. What you're looking for is a large settlement of woods or a valley to move into. The idea for moving away from the coast is to get away from that wind chill factor.
Right. Right.
You know?
Well, Bob Allison, your chair of history at Suffolk University, I'm looking at a diary entry that Samuel Sewall wrote in 1680, so well after the Pilgrims arrived, but he wrote, "Charles River frozen over. Courageous south wind breaks the ice between Boston and Dorchester Neck. Hath been a very severe winter for snow and a constant continuance of cold weather, such as most affirm hath not been for many years." I'm just wondering, when the settlers or the Pilgrims, for example, first arrived here, you know, they encountered the Wampanoag Nation, who obviously were well suited and knew how to live through winters. How did they first handle it?
I was just thinking, my first visit to Plymouth Plantation was on a bitterly cold day in December, I think. The wind was whipping off of Plymouth Bay, and the houses were drafty and cold. You were shivering inside the houses. And then we walked to the Wampanoag village, and it was beautiful inside these houses because the native people knew how to live in this environment. And the Europeans came and tried to import a technological standard that they had that really didn't suit this environment. So they shivered a lot. They had cold, drafty houses with chimneys that really sucked all of the air out. And so the native people had figured this out. It took the English a long time to make the environment adapt to them, which is what they wanted to do.
Okay, so that's an interesting distinction, right? Rather than adapting to the environment and adopting the technology that was right there with the Wampanoag, they were bent on making nature adapt to them.
Yes, they were, because they had an understanding of nature, and they were supposed to dominate nature. It was, you know, part of their mission here in the wilderness to make this adapt. So they also sought wooded places so that they could get firewood, and that's one reason that New England becomes deforested relatively quickly, is because of the need for firewood in these houses. And, you know, we may think, boy, what terrible people, they did this. Well, if we tried to live without a fuel source, we would probably do much the same thing.
Right.
So, yeah, and they did experience much colder winters here than they had in Europe, and much more snow, also hotter summers. So the climate here was different from the European climate.
Right, and I mean, much colder in a way that's almost impossible for us to imagine, since most of us luckily have heat indoors
right.
in this day and age. I mean, I'm looking at an 1857 a piece of writing from Thoreau, who's recalling the cold Friday of 1810.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that his mother told him, and he writes about it in his journal. He says, "Mother remembers the cold Friday very well. The people in the kitchen, Jack Garrison, Esther, and a Hardy girl, drew up close to the fire," which I presume was the only source of heat at the time, "but the dishes which the Hardy girl was washing froze as fast as she washed them close to the fire."
It's amazing. You know, when Benjamin Franklin was christened in 1706, he was born in January, and the family bundled up the baby and took him across the street and into the Old South Meeting House, and they had to chip the ice from the baptismal font. Actually, it was solid ice, so they could christen him. As you know, though they didn't have a heat source in the Old South, and during the British occupation of Boston in 1775 and 6, the British did cut down just about every tree in the town and also stripped the shingles and shutters and fences. They needed a source of heat. as well as a way to cook. Now, we think it was mean-spiritedness on their part, and if we tried to endure a winter without heat here, we would also become pretty desperate.
Yeah. Darius, can you describe to us for the Wampanoag, were social customs different in winter versus summer? I mean, you were saying earlier that people spend a lot of time outside regardless of the weather, but I'm wondering when nature closes in and it gets dark for, you know, so many more hours in the day, were there different traditions?
Well, during the spring, summer, and fall months, you would see like strawberry festivals happen in June. That's the first fruit of the year. You would have green corn festivals being immature corn in the month of August. You had to see harvest festivals happening. But once it got a bit of cold during the winter, that's when you probably spend more time inside. And that's when you have the elders inside telling stories at night. The women, children might be making small baskets, playing with toys. Although the men will probably be outside quite a bit because that's the best time to hunt. That's when the furs are the thickest and the meat's the best. And even during the snow, actually, that's the best time to hunt for the animal, to track the animals.
And Bob, a similar question to you. I mean, were there just different social expectations when, you know, there aren't lights necessarily to turn on to make outside, you know, bright again?
Yeah, so you would go to bed earlier because candles were relatively expensive. And the big danger for the English, of course, was that their livestock would be lost or overcome by the snow, and they needed to get in enough hay and have enough hay accessible, and the livestock getting lost in blizzards. We read a lot about this. And probably the most clever of these New England Yankees was Frederick Tudor. In the early 19th century, he figured out a way actually to ship our ice to other places that didn't have it. So taking the ice from the frozen ponds of New England and sending it to Havana or to India. It's a present thing, and life did slow down in the winter because you've done the harvesting, and so women could still do the spinning, the weaving of the wool from the sheep, and so doing those kinds of indoor processes, spinning, weaving, you've already preserved all of the food, hopefully, mm-hmm. that you need. You've gotten the hay in. You've done all of these other chores that need to be done before winter sets in. And then again, in the long winter nights, you can have the telling of stories, the reading of the Bible, and the other things that during the summer months when you're working, you don't have as much time for.
Well, aside from the bitter, bitter cold that we've been talking about, it doesn't sound like too awful a way to think about coping with winter. So I guess my last quick question to both of you, Bob and Darius, is, you know, what one lesson do you think we should take from 17th and 18th century native peoples and the settlers about how to cope with this winter that we've been experiencing? Bob?
I think endure it. It will pass, and it will come again after what we hope will be a beautiful spring, summer, and fall.
And Darius?
I agree. Endure it. It happens. We're in New England. So spring will be here.
Maybe get together around the fire and tell each other some really good stories as
well. We should.
Well, Darius Coombs is Associate Director of the Wampanoag Indigenous Program at Plymouth Plantation and a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag Nation. Darius, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Bob Allison, Chair of the History Department at Suffolk University. Really always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Darius.
Stay with us. Coming up, restoring a legacy. Magnificent objects once stolen by the Nazis, soon to be on display at the MFA. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.